Meal will be rolled out in the coming months with the aim of all 14,000 restaurants meeting new nutrition standards by the first quarter of 2012. In addition to the Happy Meal overhaul, McDonald's says it's working to reduce added sugar, saturated fats, and calories across its national menu of food choices. The chain says by 2015, their goal is to cut sodium in menu options by 15%. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
The U.S. Postal Service says it is considering closing more than 3,600 post offices and branches to cut costs, most of them in rural areas. The Postal Service is trying to trim its budget after losing $8 billion last year. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. At nearly 47,000 miles long and incorporating almost 300 million cubic yards of concrete, the Dwight Eisenhower system of interstate and defense highways is the biggest public works project in history. At the same time, the interstate system has become such a big part of American life and the American experience that we tend to overlook it. So we'll try to provide a little correction there this hour of Focus as we talk with Earl Swift. He is the author of a recently published book. The title of his book is The Big Roads, and the subtitle is The Untold Story of the Engineers, Visionaries, and Trailblazers Who Created the American Superhighways. It's published by Houghton Mifflin and is just recently out. And it's a good story, has some good stories in it. And we'll talk this morning about the interstate system. And Mr. Swift, hello.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Well, thank you. I'm doing well.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. It's, you know, I suppose one can argue either way, the benefits or the downside of the system, as people have, and we can talk about both of those things. But it's kind of hard to imagine anything that changed the life in America, had the economic impact, had the impact on people thinking about the country and experiencing the country. It's kind of hard to think of anything else that had the potential to do all of that.
Well, it certainly is hard to come up with anything else that is so easily overlooked. Mm. I mean, you can point to the advent of the automobile altogether, I guess, as the big driver of the 20th century American experience. But the interstates have had a subtle but kind of omnipresent effect on daily life, ranging from the fact that you can go into the supermarket in central Illinois and find asparagus, fresh asparagus, in the produce section at any time of year.
Mm-hmm.
Totally impossible without the interstate system. The fact that you can send an overnight package to the West Coast and expect it to get there by 10 a.m. the next day would not happen.
Yeah.
That there are, in so many ways, in the way we conceive of space and time and distance, the way we view our cities, our mental map of the United States, even, it is completely rewritten us.
Yeah. One thing that as we explore the history that I'm sure that a lot of people start with is with Eisenhower and Eisenhower's role. And if there's one person that I think probably most people will associate with the interstates, it is Dwight Eisenhower. His name is on there, but the fact of the matter is that if really we were going to say what president's name should be on the interstate system, well, probably it should be Franklin Roosevelt, and that Eisenhower's role was really, I don't know if we want to say it was minimal, but he certainly wasn't the person responsible for having the interstates built.
He was not the father of the interstates, despite the pervading public view to the contrary. He left very few fingerprints on it when you get down to it. His role was cheerleader for the financing of the system. And even in that role, he didn't get his way.
Mm. Um,
so the fact that the system started to appear on his watch is probably a big piece of the explanation as to why the interstates are now associated with his presidency or with his era, right alongside coonskin caps and, you know, the polio vaccine. He came in long after most of the big decisions were made. Mm-hmm. And you're right, FDR is the president whom, if you were going to credit, you know, if you were going to name this thing for a president, it should be called the Franklin Roosevelt system of defense, interstate defense highways.
The other thing that I think is very interesting, people think of that as the interstate system, but they might be surprised to know that it's also known as the system of interstate and defense highways. And there may also be people who have this idea in their head that, and maybe again, that has to do with the association with Dwight Eisenhower, the idea that was really the motivating factor, that someone thought for the defense and security of the United States, we needed to have a system that made it possible to move around troops and tanks and war material, and that was really the big thing behind it.
Yeah, which of course is a myth right alongside Eisenhower's authorship of the program. Yeah, you know, I guess if you take the broadest possible definition of defense, yes, the system was a defense highway system in that it connects points of manufacture to cities where military installations are based. But in terms of moving troops, moving ammunition, it was never designed to do any of that. And adding "and defense" to the title of the system was really a political bone that was thrown to members of Congress by George Fallon, the author of the House bill that became the bulk of the interstate program in 1956.
Mm. The story here is really it's a people story, and there are a lot of really interesting characters here, and that you're using to tell the story. So we should get right into talking about some of them. And I think really of all of the people, and I say there are a lot of interesting people in this book that are really remarkable characters and deserve, I don't know if you build an entire book around them, but the person here that I think is just emerges as the most fascinating and had the most impact. And again, it's one of these people that people have never heard of, is Carl Fisher. We could just go, I'm sure we could just go on for a long time about Carl Fisher. Let's just start out. What should people know about Carl Fisher?
Well, Carl Fisher is one of those Americans who ought to be a household name and isn't, and it's too bad because he was a wild man from Indianapolis who had his hands in all sorts of things at the turn of the century and the early part of the 20th century, beginning right at 1900 when he became the owner of one of the first auto dealerships in the country in Indianapolis. He developed into one of the premier auto racers in the opening years of the century. He marketed in 1904 the first practical automotive headlight. Driving until then was a daytime pursuit. Unless you were a lunatic, you didn't take to the roads at night because you couldn't see where you were going.
Mm-hmm.
But he came up with a headlight that worked, and it became standard issue on American makes, dozens of American makes, and it made him a millionaire. He took that money, and he created the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. He founded the Indy 500. He drove the pace car in the first five Indy 500s, in fact. And he took more of his money, and he created, out of a mangrove swamp, the city of Miami Beach, pretty much single-handedly. And for the purpose of this story, he got really fed up with the fact that on his Sunday drives out in Indianapolis, his car would bury itself past its axles in mud as soon as he got to the city limits. And so he proposed to a bunch of his friends in the automotive industry that they pool their money and they build a rock highway from New York to San Francisco. And, in fact, they did. And we now know it as the Lincoln Highway, US 30 for most of its length. That highway inspired other like-minded autoists, as they were called, and businessmen to build their own private sector highways by subscription. And by the early 20s, America had a primitive network of dirt auto trails is what they were called. And that was really our first interstate road network. Yeah. The government had very little hand in building it.
He was very much involved. And this is an incredible story that a bunch of guys just got together and said, you know, really what we need to do is build a road from one side of the country to the other. And let's do that. And they did.
Yeah. And the idea was that they would get the money and they would supply money and materials to localities along the way. They'd figure out what the path of their highway was going to be. And for most of its length, the Lincoln followed existing roads, but they were terrible roads. They were cart paths, mud wallows. If you go to a modern cornfield, you know, sometimes you'll see the tractor path around the edge of it, mm-hmm. where the farmer will mm-hmm. drive his tractor. That's pretty much the state of your typical inner city road circa 1912. It was a mess. And most cars of today would not have been able to negotiate them. What they did was they got all the material and money together, and they supplied to localities along the route this pile of stuff, and they left it to the localities to drum up the manpower to actually put it in place. And that worked pretty well. A lot of the auto trails that sprung up were not nearly so well organized as the Lincoln, and they, you know, some of them remained abstractions more than real auto trails for mm-hmm. for their histories, but there was great enthusiasm in the public for the idea of you know, getting someplace to drive. Americans were buying cars at just an almost inconceivable rate in the early years of the century. Our ownership of cars was doubling every 2 or 3 years, and we had no place to drive.
Mm. So, as you said, here he was interested in he had this interest in an involvement in building this major east-west road across the country that way. Also talked about the fact that he was very much involved in Florida real estate. He was also involved in building a north-south road, yeah. and was involved in building this road that was called the Dixie Highway, that so you could drive from Indianapolis to Florida.
Yeah, there were two legs of it. The Dixie was one of the auto trails that that negotiated a particularly tough path, and that was getting through the Appalachians, you know, southbound. And it wound up, there was such a clamor for inclusion along the route from cities in the south that eventually the Dixie became almost a ladder-shaped double highway joined by rungs. One branch going from Chicago, another from Indianapolis and Detroit, and it became immensely popular, and you know, at the time the papers in Atlanta were calling it, you know, the most important road since ancient Rome, that sort of thing. You know, clearly Fisher did have real estate interests in Florida, so his motivations for building the Dixie were perhaps a little less pure than they had been with the Lincoln a few years before. But still, he built two major highways and really kind of helped to kickstart the whole notion of building long distance interstates.
So he lost all of his money in the crash in 1929, and apparently, even though he had done all of this, had been a very wealthy man, had been involved in this road building, had been involved in developing real estate in Florida, that at the end of his life, he thought that he was a failure.
Quietly, he lost a big chunk of his money in 1926 when a terrific hurricane arrived in Miami unannounced and flattened Miami Beach. And at the time, Fisher was involved in inventing another town, which is Montauk at the eastern end of Long Island in New York. And his idea was that he was going to create a wintertime resort in Florida, and then he'd get all the rich people who winter down there to summer up at Montauk. And he built this lavish kind of English village, country village up there, with polo fields and yachting basins. But he used all of his money from Miami Beach. He leveraged all that to finance Montauk. And so when the hurricane hit, he suddenly found himself not only without a source of income, but completely overextended on the Montauk investment. And, you know, that really struck a blow that from which he never recovered. Then in 1929, he lost what little he had left, and he wound up doing odd jobs for friends whom he had once entertained aboard his ocean-going yacht, and died kind of a sad alcoholic figure.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Earl Swift. His new book is all about the building of the American interstate system. The title of the book is The Big Roads. Houghton Mifflin Harcourt is the publisher. And we have somebody here who'd like to join in the conversation. And anyone who is listening is certainly welcome to do that. If you'd like to call, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have somebody here to talk with in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yeah.
Right at the beginning of the show, the guest said several things that I'd like to comment on. One is the item about the name of the system, including defense. And the story about that was that the passage of this in Congress was by no means a walkover. And in order to drum up some patriotic sentiment in favor of it, they attached this defense highway part to the name. And the reason that was given was that we needed a way to make our missiles, our attack missiles, more secure, and the best way to do that was to move them around. And there was a scheme whereby missiles would be on big tow trucks, and the defense highway system would be used to move them around so that they couldn't be targeted. This was essentially a scam, because none of the overpasses were made high enough for the trailers with the missiles on them to pass under. Second thing, the guest said that without the highway system that we couldn't have things like second-day delivery of packages and fresh things in the stores and so forth. This is not only attempting to testify on behalf of the highway system, it's also indicating that the guest has perfect knowledge of what would have happened if the highway system had not been built, if instead that railroads had been developed in ways that they have been in other countries and probably would have been done even more so in the United States because we were ahead in those departments. The highway system provided killing competition because the land on which they were sited didn't pay any taxes, whereas the railroad had to pay property taxes everywhere it goes. And there's lots of other things like that, which I won't get into. The third and last item that I want to mention is that, in my opinion, the interstate system is a humongous millstone around the neck of the country because, as everyone knows, the infrastructure is falling apart. And it's extremely expensive to maintain highways, much more expensive than it is to maintain railroad right-of-way. And I'll hang on for possible follow-up.
Well, that's a lot. I also was thinking about the fact that, you probably could write a book, titled something like The American Interstate System and How It Destroyed This Country, something like that. And
the
negatives are all there. I don't mean to suggest that the caller is mistaken in bringing up the points that he does because they're certainly worth talking about. So how do you think about that?
Well, in the first item, I think it's largely a myth that moving missiles had anything to do with Congress's approval of the system. In fact, I don't think it. I know it. If you want to look at what really swayed Congress to get aboard this this notion, it had a lot more to do with the promises that the planned interstate system made to cities, and they were embodied in a document, most memorably embodied in a document that's nicknamed the Yellow Book, which was a catalog of the of every major city in the country and the interstate highways that were planned to go through it. And once congressmen saw in the Yellow Book they had before them a graphic display of how this abstract system would play out on their home turf, that had a profound effect. There was never any expectation. And I think that if you go back to the source documentation, you'll find that this is the case. There was never any expectation that highway overpasses would be made tall enough to allow missiles to pass underneath them. That is a persistent myth. that has defied serious history for 50 years now. This was played out before a congressional commission in the 60s that raised the same issue. And if you go back and you read the testimony there, you'll see that, as I'm telling you now, you know, that because defense is in the title, people jump to a conclusion that simply was never intended.
Hmm. Well, what about the notion if, you know, when Congress passed the Federal Highway Act of 1921 and started started the project of thinking about how a system might function and how it would get laid out, and then 20 years later, Franklin Roosevelt appointed a committee to really consider in a more concrete way a system of national highways. I suppose one would ask the question, if back in the 20s, if we had decided that we were going to do this in a different way, could we have done it, and would we be able to achieve the same goal of moving people and material around the country?
Well, I guess we wind up with the chicken egg question. You know, that there is often the lament made that, you know, we made a terrible mistake. Our leaders made a mistake by investing in the automobile versus rail. You know, there have been a number of books about the conspiracy among automakers to drive into extinction the urban streetcar. What's missing from all of this hand-wringing is the recognition that the American people demanded the automobile. All of these things are really moot conversations because this was not something we had foisted on us. We got the interstate highways because we demanded them. We got roads because we as a people made it clear that we would have those roads. And, you know, it's great to have 20/20 hindsight and to look back and say, gosh, we made a bad turn there. The fact is, we made the turn. We did not have it made for us. You know, this is something, the American public embraced the automobile unlike any invention that's ever come down the pike. We in the space of 25 years, became an automotive nation. No other invention that I can think of has gone from first appearance to complete societal dominance, as has the car in the United States between 1900 and 1925, say. So the argument that the government made a misstep by misinvesting our money, our taxpayers' money, in the wrong form of transportation, is blind to the notion that we weren't going to take streetcars. You know, Americans hated streetcars by the time they went bankrupt. They got in the way of our cars. Hmm.
Well, let me ask you again, to respond to the third question the caller raised, and I'm sure that this is something. Well, is it something that when the system was being conceived, they thought about the fact that once it was built. That it would have to be maintained, and that was going to be expensive. Did they think about how improvements and repairs to the system would be paid for in the future?
Well, the way it's set up is that the states, of course, you understand that the interstates are owned by the states. The feds do not own the interstate highway system. Mm-hmm. The federal government paid 90 cents of every dollar toward their construction. But the highways of the system are owned by the states through which they pass. And it is up to the states to maintain them, according to the original legislation. Now, the expectation was that if they were maintained according to a regular schedule, they'd last a long time. What's happened is that the diligence of that schedule has varied from state to state. In some states, the interstates are maybe not in terrific shape, but they're in decent shape. You need only go to Iowa, say, to find a system that's in pretty nice condition. The minute you drive on I-80 across the Mississippi into Illinois, you practically need the lunar rover to traverse, the route to Chicago. And that speaks to just the difference in priorities and in available cash. So Sure. There was the recognition that, these things had a projected service life. There was a recognition that you had to be absolutely religious about maintenance. This was a system developed by engineers, and engineers are kind of that bent, I think, by nature. And but engineers rarely make it into politics. And the folks who actually cut loose the funds to do that diligent maintenance aren't necessarily the guys who understand how desperately it's needed.
Well, I want to thank the caller. We're getting close to the middle point of the show. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The email is will-talk@illinois.edu. How did it come to that the kind of partnership here between states and federal government, with the federal government supplying most of the money, but then the states ending up owning the road and then really being responsible for the maintenance of the road? How did it turn out that way?
Well, it goes back to a debate in the teens, really, when there was a great disagreement, not only among politicians, but among highway engineers, as to whether America should have a system of national highways or a national system of highways. And that sounds like a semantic distinction, but it really kind of speaks to a debate that raged for years and years and divided people in you know, pretty firmly. In 1916, the feds and states first got together in the first Federal Aid Roads Act, and what it said was that the feds would kick in on primary roads, would kick in a substantial amount of funding help. It left to the localities, to the states, to choose where those roads would be. And this spoke to a belief on the part of many engineers that the best road was that which was most easily justified economically, and that meaning that it would be the best road was the most used road and the most useful to locals. And so rather than build a system of through highways, that 1916 Act and the later 1921 Federal Aid Road Highways Act were predicated on the notion that you would build a chain of local roads that, when strung end-to-end, created long-distance roads. And, you know, the 1921 Act took the most important of those strung-together local roads and put numbers on them. Hmm. And created of them a rational grid, and that's the numbered U.S. highway system that were the principal roads until the interstates came along 30 years later.
Well, you know, when you look at basically the map of the big roads, it seems really clear that what they were trying to do was connect major cities in the most direct way that they could, given that they also have to deal with geography. Was it that sort of obvious where it was the roads would go?
Well, it goes back to the idea that the best roads are the most used, because the interstate system shadows the principal highways of the numbered U.S. highway system from 1926. There's only one stretch of pioneer interstate that I know of that does not shadow an already existing highway, and that's the section of I-70 that goes over the San Rafael Swell in eastern Utah. Every place else, a road was there first, and the interstate was just a bigger improvement, a parallel to it. And, you know, when you look at how the routing for the 1926 roads were chosen, they were chosen not only on traffic, on the basis of traffic and use, but also on the relative prosperity of the towns through which those roads, and not only towns but counties through which those roads passed, counties that had the highest agricultural production, the highest mining production, the greatest household income. There were a number of measures that were used by the states and the Bureau of Public Roads to develop corridors for that 1926 system. And a guy named E.W. James played he was a federal engineer, played a kind of a key role in coming up with the system for figuring out where those roads would go. So if you really, you know, if you want an explanation as to why the interstates go where they do, you have to really look back 30 years before to why the numbered U.S. highway system goes where it does. But in general, the interstates, if you look at the late 30s reports, or report that kind of birthed them, report from 1939 called Toll Roads and Free Roads, they were engineered first to relieve urban congestion and those urban legs of superhighway were then kind of extended out to meet other extended urban highways to form inner city connections. Even in 1939, it was recognized that our biggest highway needs were in the cities.
In this hour, we're talking about the history of the internet system, the internet system. See, that shows you where I am, the internet system. No, the interstate system and the other highway, the one that you drive the cars on. In this hour of Focus, the guest is Earl Swift, and he is the author of The Big Roads, the untold story of the engineers, visionaries, and trailblazers who created the American superhighways. And it's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. It's out now. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. And we also have toll-free line good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We have some other callers in Pasotum. We have somebody on our line number one.
Morning.
Yes, hi.
Fascinating topic. It dispelled everything I thought I knew about the interstates, I guess was wrong. And I guess the one question, which is slightly off topic, but the Carl Fisher you mentioned, is that I believe in the old days, General Motors, they said their cars were bodied by Fisher. Was that the same Fisher?
No, it wasn't. And you know, that it's a great question, and it's a natural question. But no, the Fisher brothers that had the carriage company, they're completely different animals. They were up in Flint, I guess, and Carl was an Indiana boy his entire life.
Okay, well, because of the automotive, I thought possibly that was a connection. And is there a biography of either of those Fishers then that you researched?
Of Carl, there are three biographies, one written by his ex-wife, one written by a distant cousin, and one written by a professor down in Florida. And you know, they're very different books. I got something different out of all three, so I can't really recommend one above the others. I guess the cousins is probably the most complete, and it's not as fawning as you might think.
They're all still in print? Or
yeah, that one's called The Pace Setter.
Okay.
The untold story of Carl Fisher.
Well, great. I love your conversation, and I'll just let you get back to it because I'll find out more stuff I didn't know. Thanks.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. We'll go on here to Champaign County next, line number two. Hello.
Hi. I wasn't sure how you resolved the argument about the defense factor. My understanding, it was just a way of arguing for a massive expenditure and putting the weight of the, you know, a national security card behind it, as it were. So I don't know if that's what you said or not. You don't really have to have missiles that fit if you really have a fake missile crisis. Anyway, but that's another discussion. I had a number of things. How many segments of interstate highway are like what we have in Illinois, where the 72 doesn't go interstate? I go back far enough to remember when they were being built, and I remember in Popular Science there was an idea of having something called Century, which would be next to the interstate and would be sort of, I guess, Autobahn envy, where there'd be a faster track, which relates to my next question. There's differential treatment of the roads by different states, and I think in different counties I can see that it seems to me on 70 there seems to be a different factor, and I don't know if it's whether the trucks that tear up the road more than others and the businesses in those particular areas get better service or something. I'm not sure whether you can unpack that. But is there also a differential enforcement of the speed limit? I know some areas have 80-mile-an-hour speed limit in Texas, but it seems to me that the legal speed limit in Illinois by who they pull over is about 78. if you don't go faster than 78, they don't seem to pass the bother with you.
Yeah.
This is from a lot of driving on 70 and 57 and surely getting scoped by radar multiple times, but nobody, I put on the brakes pretty quick. So I guess if they figure you're alert enough to brake in time, you're alert enough to drive that fast or something. So quite a bit of and wide range, and I guess I'll hang up and see what gets sorted.
All right. Well, okay. I'm
hoping I can remember all those questions. So let me just tackle the defense thing and get that out of the way. I think the phrase I used earlier was that it was a label that was used to sweeten the pot in Congress, and that's exactly what it was. It was a way to make the bill tougher to oppose. You know, you add defense to it. It becomes a mom and apple pie and an all-American sort of thing. And, George Fallon and Hale Boggs and the original Al Gore, who were the sponsors of the bill in its various permutations in 1956, they wanted to see the thing passed. And I think it was Fallon who probably is most responsible for adding the defense label to it. But all three of them were beating the drum pretty fiercely for this, and they were doing whatever it took to get their people in line to get it passed. Okay, help me out here, David. What were some of those other questions?
Well, some of the I think that the caller was generally talking about speeds, and particularly was there some point when people were thinking that maybe there ought to be some kind of dedicated lane or area where essentially people could go as fast as they wanted.
Right. Well, that's kind of a variation on an idea that Norman Bel Geddes had at the 1939 World's Fair in the GM Futurama exhibit, which had a 14-lane expressway as kind of its centerpiece and 7 lanes in each direction, 4 of which would be for traffic moving at 50, 2 for traffic moving at 75, and 1 for long-distance traffic moving at 100 miles an hour. And if you go back, as the caller did, and look at some of those back issues of Popular Mechanics and Popular Science and Mechanics Illustrated, every once in a while, every couple of years, there would be a very visual feature on the highway of the future. And all sorts of ideas were test ballooned in the pages of those magazines for a newer and better highway system. So I wouldn't put a lot of credence into the notion that this century idea was ever seriously considered by the Bureau of Public Roads. I'm unfamiliar with it.
Yeah. Were there
people? I certainly know there have been lots of prognostications on the part of the technical press over the years.
Mm. Were there people who suggested there should be dedicated truck lanes?
Oh, there still are. That's still an idea that's very much alive. In fact, the guy who's probably most responsible for actually building the system, taking the concepts of the late 30s and turning them into concrete and steel, a guy named Frank Turner, was advocating that back in the early 80s, and it's proven to be an idea that has legs because it's still bandied about as one of the possible solutions to the maintenance issue in heavy truck traffic corridors.
So maybe it seems that the other area the caller was kind of talking about, in spite of the fact that when you drive the interstates, it seems like no matter where you are, it's like the same. It seems to look the same. It feels the same. Is it the case that when you pass through various jurisdictions, that those places think somehow very differently about the roads and how they should be treated and run and maintained and regulated and whatever else?
On a state basis, sure. The road, the system, like I said, is owned by the state. So when you go from one state to another, you will often notice a tremendous difference in the maintenance, not only the maintenance, but the materials used. I mean, some states, your driving surface is concrete, some it's asphalt. It's not necessarily jurisdictional, but there are some stretches within states that will bounce back and forth between materials used as well. And that has more to do with the age of that particular strip of highway and how long it's been since its last major repair, because a great many highway departments have found that while early in the interstate's history, it made sense for them to use concrete for most of their repairs because it lasts longer. It's also so expensive that they've now made the shift to asphalt. And so asphalt is becoming, with increasing frequency, the surface on which you drive throughout the system.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're coming down to about our last 10 minutes here, and I want to talk about it, give you the chance to talk about a couple of other people. And at the beginning, I just noted that the person who is often called the father of the interstate system is Dwight Eisenhower, and as we have mentioned, his name is on it. But what you write about in the book is, in fact, if there is going to be someone who truly is the father of the system, probably it's was a man who was a road engineer, a man named Thomas Harris McDonald, who headed up for quite a number of years the Federal Bureau of Public Roads, and was someone who had done road work in Iowa, and apparently during that time the roads in Iowa were pretty good because of him. And then he went on to Washington and had a lot to do with laying out the system as it is.
Yeah, well, Thomas McDonald was a guy who got to D.C. in 1919 when we really didn't have much of an interstate road system beyond the private auto trails, and stayed until 1953 when he was fired by Ike, and by which time he had overseen not only the creation of the numbered U.S. highway system, but the conceptual creation of the interstates, and had shepherded the interstates through Congress. And it was, he was a very odd man, a preternaturally uptight, insisted that his siblings call him sir, insisted that his wife call him Mr. McDonald. People at the Bureau of Public Roads knew better than to talk to Thomas McDonald before he spoke to them. They knew better than to get into an elevator with him. He was just a very, very serious, sober, uptight guy, not a lot of laughs, but a hell of an engineer and a great marshaler of forces. I should mention, he also had a huge hand in the construction of the Alaska Highway. Mm-hmm. Probably would not have been possible without his leadership. He was just a very effective bureaucrat. And if you really want to come down to the moment of conception for the interstate highway system, you have to look at February 1938 when McDonald got a call from the White House and was summoned to meet with FDR. And he went into the president's office, and FDR had a map of the 48 states in front of him, a road map. And he had taken this map and drawn in blue six lines on it, three going north-south, three going east-west from coast to coast. And he showed the map to McDonald and said, I'm interested in seeing if we can build a high-speed continental road system that kind of approximates these lines. Could you take a look at it, and could you see whether we can make it pay for itself? And so McDonald took this map back to his office, and over the next several weeks, with a large supporting cast, concluded that such a system could not be made to pay for itself through tolls or any other means, but that if you expanded on the idea, if you came up first of all with a way to finance them, and then you blew the idea up into a system aimed at reducing what was absolutely stultifying urban congestion at the time, and connecting the cities to each other, the major manufacturing centers, well, you'd have a system that would be worth having. And McDonald was a big believer in that roads had to be economically justified. So much of the interstate system that he conceived back in the late 30s was not superhighway the way we think of it now. It was limited access, but there were stretches that were just two lanes, one lane in each direction, across Wyoming and, Idaho and such. That report that he made to the president and later to Congress in a more complete form became the kind of the foundation for a second study that you mentioned a few minutes ago in 1941 into the feasibility of building a national interstate highway system. And that report prompted Congress in 1944 to actually approve the system. So, of course, at that point, Ike was a bit busy, beating Germany, and I'm sure he hadn't given a thought to running for public office, let alone to America's interstate highway needs. That's really when it happened. The conclusion to the hard work on the interstates came in 1944, and then it only became a matter of, okay, how do we pay for this thing? And it's because that formula was developed quite outside of Ike's influence while Ike was president that I think he gets the lion's share of the credit today.
Yeah.
It was on his watch.
We, as we've mentioned, as people know, what the system does is it links some of the country's biggest cities. And so, but not only does it go from the outskirts of the city, it goes through the city. And that people who, an awful lot of the traffic on the interstates is people who are just traveling in and around cities. And here we get to a point where there was, in the building of the system, a great deal of controversy because of the ways that these cities ended up being carved up by these massive roads, and about how places where there were people living and they had their houses had to be cleared to make space for the road. And here's where I want to talk, have you talk about one more person here who is not, you know, you talked about how somebody like Carl Fisher might be a household name. Joe Wiles is not someone who is particularly going to be a household name, but people, he and people like him were also very important in this story because they were very concerned with what the impact would be on urban dwellers who were be losing the places that they lived because someone decided that's where a road should go.
Yeah, well, I mean, Joe Wiles was a quiet, mild-mannered family man living on the west side of Baltimore. He was black. He lived in a middle-class black neighborhood called Rosemont that was really a village within the city. It was an enclave of professionals, people who were staunchly middle-class to upper-middle-class, better educated than the city's average, paid more than the city's average. And so this really was kind of the black community in Baltimore's gem, this little neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And when plans for Interstate 70 came through, and there were a lot of different plans for Interstate 70 over the years, but one thing that damn near all of them had in common was that this, you know, this six-lane behemoth, a 200-foot corridor, was going to blast right through the heart of Rosemont and take out everything that Joe Wiles had worked for over a good many years. And he decided he wasn't going to stand meekly by and let that happen. And so he organized his neighbors and eventually was key to organizing much of the city in opposition to what people in Baltimore just came to call the road. And the road wars is still something that people in Baltimore talk about today, 30, 40 years later, as kind of a point of community pride because the city rose up. It was really the first issue that united the races, people of all economic walks in that city. And this is a city that's very carved in neighborhoods, you know, into enclaves. And they all united in opposition to the idea of this highway. And now if you drive Interstate 70, which starts all the way west near Provo, Utah, the road suddenly dead ends with no warning whatsoever right at the city limits of Baltimore. It just stops cold. There's not even an exit there. There's a parking lot. And it's a testament to Joe Wiles and his neighbors that they were able to stop what seemed an unstoppable juggernaut when they began the fight.
Yeah. Maybe just here again, we're coming down to being very short on time. We have maybe 2 minutes. But again, there's one more person that I think at least I want to have you say something about. And it is someone that a name that people should know. And, you know, an earlier caller talked about all of the negatives people have used and all of the bad things they've said about the highway system and that are you really can't argue with. I mean, yes, those things really are true. But what's, I think, notable here is that a lot of these objections to the system and what it was going to do to America were voiced very shortly after the system was built, right really almost near the beginning.
Yeah.
And one person that you write about in the book, and again, I think is someone that people should know, is a man named Lewis Mumford. Tell us about him.
Well, the five principal characters of the book, he's the one that people might, you know, recognize the name of. He was a popular writer in his day, mostly in urban planning and the history of cities, and kind of a sociologist and urban planner, and a longtime critic for the New Yorker of architecture. And Mumford is kind of a strange figure in this saga, because in the 30s he beat the drum for the limited access highway in a story that he co-wrote for Harper's. He proposed a townless highway for the motorist that would be, and what he goes on to describe is pretty much the limited access interstate. It's a superhighway. This is at a time when that was not the kind of the collective vision for what these roads ought to look like. So it was really kind of a groundbreaking story that he co-wrote. Over the next quarter century, 30 years, he morphed into the harshest critic of the very thing that he had proposed. So, and a very effective critic. The guy could write, and he knew how to just drive a stiletto and drove it into the hearts of highway engineers from coast to coast for many years, just made a real pest of himself. And but he raised issues, as you say, early on that we didn't really kind of lament as a people until much later. The biggest being, you can't solve a traffic problem by building more roads, because roads are kind of like mountain ranges that create their own weather. You build a road and it fills up. You build another road next to it, it'll fill up. You can't build enough roads to ever have them stop filling up. Like I said, of all the figures, he's the one that it's probably the easiest to know about already and to get more information on, because he was a prolific writer and kind of threads his way throughout the story.
Well, there we'll have to stop, because we've come to the end of the time. It's a great story, and if people would like to read more about the interstate system and its history, the book to look for is The Big Roads by our guest Earl Swift. The subtitle is The Untold Story of the Engineers, Visionaries, and Trailblazers Who Created the American Superhighways. Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, publisher. Mr. Swift, thanks very much for talking with us.
David, thanks for having me.
All right. You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Many of our past shows, along with local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Patents are meant to be the best friend of inventors and innovation, but that's rarely the case in the software business.
Basically, it's a killer for creativity.
It's basically a flim-flam game that anybody who knows how to take advantage of it is doing.
How patents have become a weapon in Silicon Valley. That story today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers, because everything they do starts with you.
At 2 minutes before 11 o'clock with this market update, I'm Tom Rogers in for Dave Dickey. The corn has turned upward as we head into the next hour of trading. It had been a little bit sideways before it's moved up a little bit. And the wheat has turned for the lower. Hard red winter wheat for September in Kansas City right now trading down 2.5 cents at 767 and a half. The December at 793 and a half, down 2.75 as well. September wheat in Chicago is down 4 cents a bushel at 684 and a half. December 724 3/4, down 4.25 cents. Corn for September now up 4.75 cents a bushel now at 683 and a half. The December 680 down or up 5.5. March is up 5.5 as well at 692 3/4. Crude oil for September at $99.39, that's up 19 cents after being down a little earlier in the day, edging toward that $100 a barrel mark again. Soybeans for August are up 14.75 cents on the crop condition report that showed a little worse condition than expected. That's standing right now at 13.80 and a half, up 15 cents now. September up 14.5 at 13.79. November 13.87, up 15 cents. January up 14 at 13.96. August soybean meal 359.40. That is 359.50 now. That's up 370. Soybean oil for August at 56.51. That's up 41. On the Mercantile Exchange livestock side, August live cattle are at $110.50 a hundredweight. That's down 15. August feeder cattle are up a nickel at $136.10. And the lean hog contract for August at $99.70, now down $122.50. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 65 points, or about a half a percent, at 12,528. NASDAQ is up now a penny and a half, or a point and a half, rather, at 2844. And the S&P 500 index is down 3 at 1334. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. Our next